Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line David Wade. And every December 7th, we have David on to talk about a book he's written called Infamy Revisited, Another Look at Pearl Harbor. It's 63 years since Pearl Harbor took place. I can remember, as if it were yesterday, it seems, when one of my friends came over, I think I was 11 or 12 at the time, and told me that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. And it really came as such a shock to think about this happening, and of course, America was plunged into war. But there were rumors at that time that the government had known ahead of time the attack was coming, and purposely and intentionally did not warn the commanders at Pearl Harbor and left those thousands of American boys to die. 2,800, something like that, perished. Many of the boys who went down on the Arizona, they never tried to recover their bodies. They just left them there. And you can go to Pearl Harbor today, and you can see the memorial there where the Arizona is, and you'll see just the masks and maybe the top of ship sticking out of the water. The rest of it is interred there with all those young men who I believe were betrayed by their government intentionally and purposely so that we could be drawn into World War II. And there was a reason for this. We certainly, after World War I, and nobody could really explain why we had World War I, unless you understood that there was a secret society created by Cecil Rhodes that controlled the British government and had certainly connections in the United States at that time. And their goal was to bring about a world government, but the only way you'd bring about a world government and world peace was to have another war. They'd already created the Boer War. That was to be the first stepping stone along the way to bringing world peace. Then the First World War was to bring about world peace, and 21 million people died. But Europe was, at the end of that war, the terrible carnage. People have no idea how terrible that war was. There were 400,000 Frenchmen who fell at Verdun. We make fun of the French. Oh, who needs enemies when, when you have your Frenchmen as your friends, or, going to war with the Frenchmen is like, going hunting with an accordion. They always make fun of the French, but 400 gallant Frenchmen fell at Verdun, and 400,000 Germans fell at Verdun in senseless attacks, bayonet attacks against machine guns, and it was organized and intentional carnage just to create such a horror that people would accept world government down the line. At the end of the First World War, they were ready to accept world government, and then, of course, when America didn't go in, the Second World War was inevitable. And now the Third World War is inevitable, I really fear, because, of course, we've had another Pearl Harbor. We'll be back in just a moment. David Wade is our special guest this evening, and we're going to spend 2 hours talking about Pearl Harbor. We will welcome your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And until the American people understand that the other side, the people who created this attack, talked about what we needed was a catastrophic and catalyzing event like another Pearl Harbor to accomplish their goal. And you'll find that in the PNAC website up on the internet at newamericancentury.org. Well, our guest this evening is David Wade. David, how are you tonight?
Good evening.
Have you had a busy time doing programs?
We have had a very busy time, as you might imagine, but the response has been of a magnitude that I did not expect. It's really surprising how many people are still interested in Pearl Harbor, an event that occurred 63 years ago.
Well, tell us what sort of response have you been getting from people. Do people see the similarity between what happened on 9/11 and Pearl Harbor?
It is very gratifying how many people have brought out that parallel. It is very gratifying how many people who have interviewed me have, without any solicitation on my part, raised that question. Aren't there parallels here? Do we know how much the government really knew before 9/11? Do we know that in fact we were really taken by surprise when the World Trade Center was struck by terrorists? And also, other interviewers have brought out other parallels. For instance, the rounding up and impoundment of Japanese citizens on the West Coast, and the rounding up and impoundment of Muslims who were suspected of being connected somehow or other with terrorist plots, the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus in both instances. There are parallels between Pearl Harbor and 9/11, and matter of fact, there are a number of them that I myself had not thought of until they had been brought to my attention by very perceptive interviewers.
But of course, the major thing was both incidents were used to get us into a war. And a war that was really far different. After all, it was the Japanese who attacked the United States. But, of course, we were simply waiting for an excuse to go to war with Adolf Hitler. That's what it was all about.
Well, that's an interesting thing, too, because everybody knows that Roosevelt was really more interested in waging war against Hitler than he was against Japan. And isn't it fascinating that the attack on the World Trade Center should end up getting us embroiled in a war against Iraq, which had no more to do with the attack against the World Trade Center than Germany had to do with the attack against Pearl Harbor.
Of course, the president explains he just had faulty intelligence. It was just a mistake. They gave him bad advice, and that's why he attacked. Well, if that's the case, then why don't you just pull our troops out and say we made a mistake? Mm-hmm. Oh, we can't do that, you know. The world is better off without Saddam Hussein.
You're right, because great nation states never admit that they make mistakes.
Well, we're
going to do that, of course, damages our prestige, and that's something that we cannot tolerate.
Now hold just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is David Wade, and he's been all day talking on radio programs the last couple of days about the Pearl Harbor attack, because his book, Infamy Revisited, is certainly an excellent overview of what happened. It's not a long book. It's perhaps 125 pages. But, you know, it's a book that 111 pages, actually. It will give you an excellent overview and a review of all the other excellent books that have been written. And here you can then crystallize everything that is known today about the betrayal of those men who were left there to die. But, you see, it was for a greater good. It was going to get us into a war, the war that was going to end all wars. Now, that was the slogan of the First World War, the war to make the world safer democracy. That was the slogan of the First World War. Why are we using it again? Why we want to bring democracy to the Middle East? That's what it's about. We're fighting to bring democracy to the Middle East. They talked about that back in 1915, 1916, 1917. That's why we sent our boys over to sea to fight. 125,000 of them died in a war that nobody really understood.
The war
afterwards.
To end all wars.
Right.
It's the war to make the world safe for democracy, as President Woodrow Wilson put it.
Right. Well, let's get, of course, into what we know about what led up to Pearl Harbor. And there are many, many people that believe that President Roosevelt actually engineered or manipulated the Japanese into the attack. Would you like to give the background of why people would have thought such a terrible, terrible thing that an American president would force an enemy into attacking us and then use that to justify going to war with Japan and in Europe?
Well, let's look at some indisputable facts. The United States did not react at all when Japan, back in 1931, invaded Manchuria and made it a conquered province of Japan. Manchukuo, the Japanese called it. We stayed out of that altogether. But then when Japan later invaded mainland China, there was a great deal of sympathy for the Chinese on the part of the United States. Nonetheless, President Roosevelt took no stand. It wasn't until the war in Europe broke out in 1939 that all of a sudden the Roosevelt administration began to sympathize with Chiang Kai-shek and the Chinese nationalists who were attempting to repel the Japanese invaders. Then there came a series of maneuvers on the part of the United States. We ended up imposing an embargo against Japan on strategic materials, and most significantly, oil.
In other words, they couldn't buy oil anywhere in the world, and we kept other countries from selling oil to Japan, and they were totally dependent upon oil for industrial
society. That was the stranglehold. The Japanese Navy would vanish as an operating force within 9 months without imported oil. And we had a chokehold on Japan when we enacted an oil embargo. And not only that, but the Roosevelt administration rebuffed any attempt by the Japanese to negotiate a peaceful settlement in China. And there is evidence to indicate that the Japanese were seriously interested in this. As a result of that, the Japanese Prime Minister Konoye actually fell from power in October because he could not get an agreement with the Roosevelt administration. He could not negotiate terms that would allow the Roosevelt administration to loosen the embargo. And he lost face. And he was succeeded by Hideki Tojo, who was a militarist and an army officer. He became prime minister, and his policy was, well, if Roosevelt is not going to negotiate with us, and if the embargo is going to continue, then we're really left with two alternatives. One is to renounce our war in China and withdraw from it, or the other is to strike against the United States. We can't renounce our war in China and withdraw from China. Thousands of Japanese soldiers have died in this war. It's been going on for years now. We have an enormous investment in it. And therefore, the only realistic alternative is that we have to strike at the United States and Great Britain in the Pacific. We have to conquer the oil-producing islands, Java, Sumatra, and we have to defeat the United States and compel them to let us purchase oil from them again. And this was the thinking that finally prevailed because of Roosevelt's deliberately provocative foreign policy towards Japan.
Now, can you discuss a little bit about Commander McCullough's directive that he'd sent to President Roosevelt sometime before the war?
Yeah, Arthur H. McCullough was a young naval officer who had a personal relationship with Franklin D. Roosevelt. They knew each other quite well.
And also, hadn't he lived in Japan? So we understood.
He had lived in Japan, right. Yes. As a matter of fact, there's a charming story that he was actually the man who taught the young Emperor Hirohito, back when he was still the Crown Prince of Japan, how to dance the Charleston. He was the son of Christian missionaries who actually grew up in Japan. And he was well acquainted with Japanese culture. He was a believer in using force against Japan. Matter of fact, he felt that we ought to provoke a war with Japan.
And didn't he actually give an memorandum?
He wrote an 8-point memorandum that was on October 8, 1940. And he outlined just exactly what we needed to do.
As a matter of fact,
in the preface to this memorandum, he makes very clear that the whole point of this is to get America into war with Japan. Now, a residual benefit of this is that it might lead us into war with Germany, since Japan was also allied with Germany at this time. But even if he didn't, he thought that war against Japan in the Pacific would be justified because it was generally believed that the Japanese would strike against Great Britain and their possessions in Southeast Asia. And if America got involved in a war with Japan in the Pacific, we could come to the aid of the British, who, of course, were opposing Hitler in Germany, and therefore, indirectly, we would make a great contribution to the defeat of Germany going to war in the Pacific against Japan on the side of Britain. And he outlined all of this, and the astounding thing is that the Roosevelt administration did, in fact, adhere to this memorandum, every single point of it.
And I think, could you want to just lay out what those specific points were? Because they were all points that were designed to provoke the Japanese.
One was an embargo. That was probably the most important point. Another one was violation of Japanese territorial waters.
We did that.
Well, yeah, we sent ships into Japanese territorial waters in an attempt to provoke incidents that might possibly lead to an outbreak of hostilities. Another one was to station American vessels in the British port of Singapore. Now, we did not actually execute that before Pearl Harbor, but there were plans to do it. We had negotiated an arrangement with Great Britain that would permit us to do it. Another one was moving the American fleet, the Pacific Fleet, from their safe bases in San Diego and San Pedro and the California coast to Hawaii, where they would be present to intimidate the Japanese, so McCollum said. By doing that, we also brought them within range of a Japanese attack.
In other words, it was a very, very easy, much far easier for the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor than it would have been for them to attack the west coast of the United States.
Oh, yeah, I think that would have been logistically impossible. It was quite a stretch even for them to attack Pearl Harbor, but it was just within their grasp.
So everything was done to actually precipitate the war. And, of course, there are many people who today justify what happened, saying, well, you know, but we had to do something. The end justifies the means. Yes, it's terrible about those boys dying, but we needed to get into the war because we had to stop the terrible of the evil Adolf Hitler. And he was an evil man, but people have forgotten that he was built up by American corporations. We have the books written, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. We financed him. I found a letter from the American Ambassador Dodd to Colonel House back in 1936 asking why American corporations were building up the German war machine, 100 American corporations building up the German war machine when they couldn't get any money out of there. And it was not only before the war, but during the war, American corporations and American banks actively helped the enemy. There's a book called Trading with the Enemy. We have a number of books going into how Americans financed the Germans, and then, of course, after the war, why the CIA brought many of the Nazi war criminals to the United States, about 1,000 of them. But even more than that, the CIA, through something called the Rat Line, helped 10,000 of the most vicious Nazi war criminals escape to South America, men like Adolf Eichmann, Klaus Barbie, Dr. Mengele, Martin Bormann, and it's all covered in a 4-tape set we have called Operation Paperclip. We have a video called The Rat Line. We don't offer it, but I can tell you how to get it, where Sam Donaldson actually went down and talked to many of these 10,000 Nazis living in Paraguay and Brazil. So if the Nazis were so terrible, why did our intelligence agencies help them after the war? Maybe nothing. Nothing as it appears to be. We'll be back here in just a moment with David Wade to discuss Infamy, another look at Pearl Harbor. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is David Wade. So David's been telling us about how Commander McCollum's a directive to the president was actually carried out step by step to provoke the Japanese attack. Why don't you pick up the story from there, David?
Well, we know that we were deliberately provoking the Japanese. We know that Prime Minister Konoye fell from power because he was unable to reach an agreement with the United States, and he was succeeded by Tojo, who was inclined to attack the United States as the only answer to the dilemma that the Japanese had been faced with due to the American embargo. But we also know that in the fall of 1941, the State Department under Cordell Hull was considering entering into some serious negotiations with Japan, and in return for Japan's agreement to halt further aggression in Indochina, we would consider selling them some oil and some rice and some other strategic materials. President Roosevelt said, we can baby them along for a while. But suddenly, on the 25th of November, our policy reversed itself 180 degrees. And Cordell Hull issued to Japan an ultimatum. It withdrew the offer to sell some oil and some rice and some other strategic materials to Japan in return for the Japanese renouncing further aggression in Indochina. It issued an ultimatum which said Japan has to withdraw from all of China immediately, which the Japanese, by the way, interpreted to include Manchuria, or Manchukuo, which it had occupied since 1931. And then it must also renounce its treaty commitment with Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. Well, these were non-negotiable demands that it would have been impossible for any sovereign nation to comply with.
And that's why we made them that way, that we knew they could not comply.
We knew that they would not comply with them. They wouldn't give up all of China, and they wouldn't renounce their treaty with the only friends they had in the world at that time, Italy and Germany, in return for getting some oil and some rice. This was a complete 180-degree reversal of what our policy had been up until the 25th of November.
And you know what
happened on the 25th of November to cause this reversal? This is a question that historians have pondered.
Well,
I think... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I went to Yale University. I went to Secretary of War Simpson's diary. Of course, he was CFR, Skull and Bones, one of the insiders. And he, in his diary, and we'll send copies of the pages to anybody out there who requests them, Secretary of War Simpson said that on the 25th of November, he and about five or six other people of the little clique who were running things went to the White House, met with the president, and the president said, we will be at war with Japan within the next week or so, probably by next Monday, which was, of course, or next Sunday or Monday. And, of course, the only question is how we were going to get in the war and get the Japanese to fire the first shot with as little damage as possible.
Oh, yes. That's an indisputable part of the record.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I'm talking with David Wade about what I have and I found in Secretary of War Simpson's diary. Other people have quoted it, but we actually have the pages from the diary we got from Yale University, where Secretary of War Simpson said he'd gone to the White House, and Admiral Stark was there, General George Catlett Marshall was there, Secretary of War Forrestal was there, and I think there was one other person, and the President. And the President had said, we will be at war with Japan within the week. And, of course, we're expecting a sneak attack. The only question is how we are going to get into this war and get the Japanese to fire the first shot and have as little damage to our own forces as possible. And, of course, that's what it was all about. We had to get the Japanese to fire the first shot because the American people didn't want to go to war. They had to have an incident. They had to provoke an incident.
Absolutely.
And they knew it was coming. That's what's so tragic, and they left those boys there to
die. And President Roosevelt was a very canny politician who had a profound psychological insight into the way that the public thought. And what he wanted to make sure of is that we got into this war as victims of a dastardly sneak attack. If he had warned our commanders in the field, Admiral Kimmel and General Short, that an attack was coming, they may very well have taken countermeasures, and they may have actually struck at the Japanese first.
Or even that, the Japanese might not have attacked if they really had realized that America was prepared.
He didn't want that. That's right. He wanted to make it look like these dirty Japs hit us, took us by surprise when they were supposedly negotiating with us in Washington, D.C. They stabbed us in the back, and boy, would people get mad. And they did. There would be an eruption of indignation and anger that would rally the nation behind the administration. And it did. There was only one person in the House of Representatives or the Senate of the United States that voted against the declaration of war, Jeanette Rankin, who incidentally had also been in Congress in 1917 and had voted against the declaration of war then. She was a pacifist. Every other single member of the Senate and the House of Representatives voted for Roosevelt's declaration of war because public opinion rallied behind him almost unanimously. Even isolationists that had previously opposed our getting into the war, such as Charles Lindbergh and Henry T. Ford, came out and said, "This is it. We are at war. We've got to defeat Japan."
But I think the thing is that the American people don't realize that on the 6th of December, nobody wanted to go to war. There was probably one American in 100 who wanted to get into another war because they already realized how fruitless and nonsensical the First World War was, and all those boys had really died for nothing. Nobody could really understand why we had the First World War.
There was a great backlash against the First World War, and there was a feeling we would supposedly went to war to make the world safer democracy, and here 20 years later, Europe is ruled by dictators. We went to war to make the world, it was supposed to be the war to end all wars, and here 20 years later, the whole world is at war again. An enormous cynicism about the First World War, in which 90,000 American soldiers were killed in combat, in a very short period of time, too, from about the Battle of Cantigny in June of 1918 to the armistice on November 11th. In that short period of time, 90,000 Americans were killed in combat. And there was a feeling that they died in vain.
And so by December 8th, 1941, almost everybody was ready to go to war. It's sort of like very few people wanted to go to war in the Middle East on September 10th, 2001. But everybody was ready to go to war on September the 12th. 2001,
exactly.
But the only question,
exactly,
who were we going to go to war with?
It was the same sort of thing, wasn't it? It was a sneak attack, which united public opinion almost unanimously against in the case of Pearl Harbor, the Japanese, in the case of 9/11, against Osama bin Laden.
But, of course, we didn't go to war with Osama bin Laden. We know from, and anybody wants to see, the staff report from the 911 Commission, which was never published for the public, but we have copies of it. Sheikh Omar, the head of the Taliban, pleaded with Osama bin Laden not to attack the United States. All the Taliban leaders did not want to attack the United States. Most of the leaders of Al-Qaeda did not want to attack the United States. The only one who was intent upon the attack was bin Laden and a very, very small number of people.
And the main point is that Iraq had absolutely nothing to do with it.
And even more amazing, we did not try to get Osama bin Laden. And anybody who doubts that, we have an article published in the Washington Times on the 7th of October. We'll be glad to send you a free copy that said, a high government official said, we're not trying to get Osama bin Laden. If we got Osama bin Laden, how would we justify the war? Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is David Wade, but we're talking about something that happened 63 years ago. But if you don't understand the past, why you're condemned to repeat it? So said Judge Sartiano. And this is why we're spending this evening, 63 years after Pearl Harbor, talking about Pearl Harbor, because we know that the other side, the people who wanted this war, were planning on it. You can go up on the internet and pull down the Bremer Commission report on terrorism. It's the National Commission on Terrorism. You can't find it. We can always, of course, get you the cover page and the website. But this was a year before the report, the commission headed by Paul Bremer. And you may not know who he is, but he was works for Kissinger and Associates. He's one of the elite members of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was the dictator we put in charge of Iraq after the military victory there, at least after the force initially retook control. And Paul Bremer put out a report a year before 9/11 talking about the coming terrorist attack on America, but the whole first part of it was about December 7th, the attack on Pearl Harbor, and how, of course, and you wonder why he has this talking about Pearl Harbor when he's talking about the coming terrorist attack on America. And he said, oh, Pearl Harbor was, oh, well, it was, everybody was just so incompetent. Everybody was so confused. Everybody couldn't talk with one another. We just had a total inability to coordinate anything. That's why Pearl Harbor occurred. And that's not why it occurred at all. They knew exactly where the Japanese fleet, they knew exactly when the attack was coming, they knew the hour it was coming, and they intentionally did not warn the commanders there at Pearl Harbor. And we'll be discussing more about that. And then, of course, we know that in September of the year 2000, the Project for the New American Century published a report. It's called Rebuilding America's Defenses, and you'll find that on their website, newamericancentury.org. That's www.newamericancentury.org, on their website. And these are the people who really planned the war, been planning it for years before the 9/11 attack. And there they talk about, in that report, that we're not going to be able to accomplish our goals without a catastrophic and catalyzing event like another Pearl Harbor. That was just 12 months before the 9/11 attack, and lots of people have likened what happened on 9/11 to another Pearl Harbor. But, of course, was it another Pearl Harbor because it was a sneak attack? Or was it another Pearl Harbor because they knew the attack was coming and did nothing to stop it? A recent Zogby poll in August of this year showed that 49.3% of the people living in Washington, in New York City, were polled, believed the government knew the attack was coming and didn't try to stop it. And that's a terrible thing to think it. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is David Wade, and we're talking about Pearl Harbor. And so, David, of course, now we've pretty well established that the government had done everything that Commander McCullough had suggested to provoke the Japanese. Then, of course, the Japanese had decided to attack. We had broken their code, the Purple Code, the diplomatic code. Mm-hmm. We'd broken the naval code. So you pick up the story from there.
Well, we knew from the Purple Code that the Japanese were planning to attack the United States. There was no doubt about that. We knew from naval intercepts that the Japanese were going to launch a strike force that was going to be headed towards Hawaii. The senior intelligence officer of the United States Navy in Hawaii was a man by the name of Joseph Rochford, and Rochford had been receiving dispatches of Japanese decoded messages from Naval Station CAST, which was the code name for the Naval Station intelligence operation in the Philippines. They were informing him that from all over the Pacific, Japanese submarines were converging to form a vanguard for an advancing strike force. And that strike force was gathering in the Japanese home waters and off the Kuril Islands in northern Japan. And the most likely objective would be, of course, our fleet at Pearl Harbor. There were other possible targets. There were Guam and there were Wake. And as a matter of fact, the Japanese did attack both of these, as well as Johnson Islands, which was an American mandate in the Pacific. The Japanese did attack Guam. They did attack Wake, but also Pearl Harbor, which of course was the biggest, the most obvious target. If you are going to start a war with a surprise attack against your enemy, and you have one chance and one chance only to get that blow in with the element of surprise on your side, obviously you are going to pick the biggest target, the one that would do him the most damage. So it was simply a matter of elementary logic to conclude that the target would be Pearl Harbor. Well, Watchford was receiving these intercepts from the Philippines. They were being decoded, and then they were being shipped to the Office of Naval Intelligence on Connecticut Avenue in Washington, D.C. Who never saw any of them? Admiral Kimmel. General Short. No, our commanders in Hawaii. They were out of the loop, as they say. And all of the Purple Code, all of the Purple Code deciphers were kept from Admiral Kimmel and General Short. They never saw a single one of them. They were kept in the dark.
And I think even more amazing is that I know of Admiral Kimmel's book called Admiral Kimmel's Story. He tells how he kept getting these letters from General Short, Admiral Stark, Chief of Naval Operations, mm-hmm. telling him that if war came, it would be in the Philippines. If war came, it would be in the Philippines. No mention at all of the fact that the people in Washington, D.C. anticipated the attack to come on Pearl Harbor.
That is correct. There were two war warnings that were sent to our commanders in Hawaii, and actually the first one was rather more explicit than the second one, but the first one listed a number of places where they thought the Japanese might attack, including the Philippines. Well, Hawaii was never mentioned. And from that, Admiral Kimmel quite plausibly drew the conclusion that apparently our intelligence did not think that a Japanese attack against Hawaii was very likely because it wasn't mentioned. The second war warning that was sent by General Marshall to Kimmel and Short told them to prepare for a possible attack, but at the same time it said don't do anything that would disturb the civilian population, which is strangely contradictory. How are you supposed to do that? Well, what General Short did was put Hawaii on a low level of alert so as not to do anything that might draw attention to our preparations and disturb the civilian population. He sent a message back to Marshall and told him that he had done this and that he was instituting certain precautions to guard against sabotage by the Japanese-American population in Hawaiian Islands. Well, he received no response from Marshall. If Marshall thought that Short had responded in an inadequate way, he should have answered and said, hey, listen, that's not what I mean. I mean, you should be ready for a Japanese attack, and you've got to do more than simply guard yourself against the possibility of sabotage.
And I think it's so important. I think it's so important for our listeners to understand that going on sabotage alert means that you took all of the Army fighter planes
yeah.
and you put them in a little close circle so you could surround them with guards.
That's right.
And of course, prevent them from being sabotaged, but what a wonderful target for the incoming Japanese planes.
That's right.
And that was exactly what was intended. They wanted a target. They wanted to entice the Japanese to attack.
And Short told Marshall that that's what he was doing.
Right.
And Marshall never objected to it. And, of course, the old principle is that silence gives assent. If Marshall did not object to it, and if he told Marshall that's what he was doing, then Short quite understandably concluded that he had done the right thing. But then, after the attack took place, he was dismissed from his command and charged with negligence. He was accused of not following through on the war warning. Nothing could be further from the truth. He did follow through on it. He took the steps that he thought were necessary, and he was not contradicted by Marshall. And therefore, he concluded quite reasonably that he had done the right thing.
And so there on the morning of the 7th of December, nobody in Pearl Harbor was anticipating an attack, and yet, of course, many hours earlier in Washington, D.C., they'd already have gotten the deciphered the 14th part of a 14-part message sent from the Japanese in Japan to the Japanese embassy there in Washington, D.C.
Ambassadors Nomura and Caruso were waiting for that 14th part to come in. And there was a delay in its transmission due to the fact but there was nobody at the Japanese embassy who could type very well. And the transcript had to be retyped. And they finally found some guy who, using the Hunt and Peck method, was able to type a transcript of the 14th part of the message. But it was late. Originally, the Japanese had planned to present the 14th part of the message to Secretary of State Cordell Hull an hour before the attack. It didn't reach him until after the attack. And so, of course, the Japanese were accused of executing a sneak attack. They were, in a way, because they only gave an hour notification. But the way it was supposed to be is that we were supposed to have been notified an hour beforehand that Japan had declared war on us.
Well, of course, the thing was that we already knew what was in that transmission because we'd broken the code, and they knew early in the morning.
Oh, sure.
That was supposed to be delivered, I think, 12 or 1 o'clock.
Sure. We knew about it. We knew about
many
it
hours
early,
ahead of time.
Early in the morning of December, Washington time, about 2 hours before the attack actually took place. But you know the story of the mysterious disappearance of General Marshall.
Why don't you explain that? Because actually, they knew, my understanding is they knew it's 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. The attack was going to come, but it was going to come Washington time, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon,
mm-hmm.
because
that's
that
right.
was the dawn in Pearl Harbor.
General Marshall's habit was to go for a horseback ride Sunday mornings, but he was usually back within an hour or so. That particular morning on the 7th of December, he didn't come back. He was gone for a very long while, and nobody was knew exactly where he was. There was his intelligence officer, a man by the name of Colonel Rufus Bratton, who was trying to track him down to give him the 14th part of this message, which had just come through and been decoded, and which said that Japan was breaking off diplomatic relations with the United States, which was tantamount to a declaration of war. Rufus Bratton couldn't find General Marshall. Well, General Marshall finally showed up, and Bratton said, "Look, we've got to notify all of our bases in the Pacific that there's going to be a Japanese attack somewhere." And at first, General Marshall was very hesitant, and this really. Bratton was very curious about his attitude. I mean, this is very important, high priority stuff. You would think he would want to get right on it, but he said, "Well, maybe I better consult with President Roosevelt first." Or blah blah blah, and finally, after hemming and hawing, he said, "Well, I'll tell you what I will do. I will send a message out." Well, you would have thought that the logical thing for him to do would be to pick up the scrambler phone there was a scrambler phone, which connected him with all of our principal military bases all over the world. And the first thing he would do would be to call Pearl Harbor, which is where our fleet was, which was the most obvious target. If the Japanese are going to attack, where they could do the most damage would be at Pearl Harbor. But no, he decided, no, I'm not going to use the scrambler phone because, gee, the Japanese, maybe they've tapped our phone wire. And if they've tapped our phone, then they, by overhearing this conversation, they will know that we've broken their code. Well, I mean, that was really a very lame excuse. As a matter of fact, that same scrambler system was the same system that Franklin D. Roosevelt had been using for months to call and make transatlantic phone calls to Winston Churchill. And there was never any concern about security in that instance. So why all of a sudden did Marshall become concerned about using the scrambler phone? Very mysterious behavior. Well, then the next thing he said was, well, we can send a radiogram over the so-called WAR war system, which was owned and operated by the American military, and that will reach our military bases directly. But then he said that there was some sort of trouble with doing that, that there was trouble on the line, and he didn't think that that was advisable either. So finally he sat down and he wrote out a handwritten message, and he gave it to one of his subordinates and told them, well, we can't use the war system, the WAR system, because apparently there's trouble on the line there, so send us by way of Western Union, which is what finally was done.
Now, of course, he could have used the naval radio. Maybe there was a problem with the Army radio reaching Pearl Harbor, but he could have used the naval radio.
Well, apparently he didn't think of that.
Well, I think he didn't want to. He decided he wasn't going to. In fact, everything was done to justify a foreign.
I mean, it sounds like a man who's stalling.
Right, right. And he's obviously stalling.
He's trying to kill time.
And, I mean, how many war commanders faced with an imminent attack on a naval base that is totally unprepared for an attack, how many would send the message by Western Union?
Well, we all know the upshot of the story, how a boy on a bicycle arrived with a Western Union telegram for Admiral Kimmel telling him he was going to be attacked at the time that the attack was just coming to an end, and our Pacific Fleet was sitting at the bottom of the harbor, and Battleship Row was a tangled mass of melting metal and flame and smoke.
And almost 3,000 Americans were dead.
Yeah, the attack was already over and had succeeded by the time that Kimmel finally got this telegram from Western Union.
And, you know, there was a movie that came out about 3 or 4 years ago with Ben Affleck. It was called Pearl Harbor, and I suggest you go out and get that movie and watch it. It's a love story, and it's dramatic because it was a dramatic incident. But there, of course, is the culmination of the attack, you know, and Admiral Kimmel is just standing there in disbelief, looking out over Pearl Harbor of his command. And here comes a little boy on the bicycle with a telegram from Western Union. Now, anybody who believes that happened by accident probably honestly believes that we were getting faulty information about the weapons of mass destruction or the fact that Saddam Hussein was about to attack New York, and we couldn't wait another day. We had to attack him immediately. And, of course, this is how the whole system works. Or we just, we're going to attack Afghanistan because we've got to get the wicked Osama bin Laden. But, gee, we can't find the wicked Osama bin Laden. And, to chucks, he got away for the 13th time. You know, anybody who believes these stories has to be incredibly naive. So here, of course, is Pearl Harbor and engulfed in flames and smoke. And then, of course, the aftermath of that was they needed to have a scapegoat, and they could never tell the American people the truth about the connivance of the people in Washington, D.C. So Admiral Kimmel and General Short became the scapegoats. Would you like to tell a little bit about the investigations and what happened after that?
Well, there were a whole series of investigations, starting with Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox, who flew out to Pearl Harbor right after the attack. And he wrote up a very cursory, superficial report blaming Kimmel and Short Then there was an investigation that was undertaken by Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Robert Jackson, who was a Roosevelt appointee, and Roosevelt himself appointed him head of this committee.
Sounds like the 911 commission.
You're investigating yourself, basically, is what it was in both cases. He had a member of his cabinet and an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court that he had named to the Supreme Court investigating his administration. And, of course, in both cases, he came up with a clean bill of health, and the blame was put on Kimmel and Short. Then there was also a congressional investigation in 1946. But the problem with that was that there were many people who were ordered by their military superiors not to testify.
Or to lie, and many of them did. And this is the great tragedy. When you have corruption in government, you tell people to lie, and an awful lot of them will. There were one or two.
Absolutely. That's the military. You get an order from your commander, you are to follow it. And there was a lot of suborned evidence, I believe. A lot of suborned testimony, I should say, I believe, in that investigation.
And the people who told the truth were discredited and demonized, sort of like David Franklin, I think that's his name, of course, who testified recently about the corruption of the FDA. And they're not going after the FDA. They're going to go after Dr. Franklin. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, this evening. Of course, is David Wade. We're talking about his book, Infamy Revisited. It's the story of Pearl Harbor. It's an excellent overview of Pearl Harbor with a summary of all of the other books that have been written prior to this time. You've read an awful lot of books before you wrote this one, didn't you, David?
Well, yes, going back to the early revisionist historians, Harry Elmer Barnes and Charles Edward Tansel. Harry Elmer Barnes taught history at Columbia University, and he wrote a book called Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace.
That's must reading for anybody who really wants to understand what this is about.
Charles Edward Tansel was a distinguished professor of diplomacy who taught at Georgetown University and wrote the book Backdoor to War. And the title is self-explanatory. Tansel believed that Roosevelt wanted to get into a war against Hitler, and having been frustrated in an attempt to make a provocation in the North Atlantic, turned to the Pacific and provoked Japan, believing that if Japan attacked the United States, Hitler would declare war against the United States because the Japanese were his allies, and in fact Roosevelt calculated correctly.
So this is the great tragedy, and of course if you read that book, The Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace, there's a section in that where Charles Austin Beard, a well-known historian at that time, talked about how the information was being covered up by the Rockefeller Foundation and the Council on Foreign Relations. I think that's...
Oh, yes, they were active in those days, too, and so was British intelligence. We should mention the man called Intrepid.
William Stevenson's wonderful book.
William Stevenson, yes. How British intelligence was operating in this country to get us into the war long before Pearl Harbor.
How they were actually killing people in the United States with the full coverage and help of the FBI, who knew that they were killing people and the people that they felt were German agents, and we were totally unconcerned about it. We allowed them to murder people in the United States because the FBI was working with the British intelligence to get America... manipulate America into the Second World War.
That is exactly correct, unfortunately. And there are so many stories. The fabrication of the phony map that showed that the Germans had plans to conquer Latin America, for instance, that was passed on to President Roosevelt by British intelligence.
You just hang on to that thought. We'll be back in there, and as we get into the second hour, here with David Wade, author of a fascinating book we recommend to you entitled Infamy. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and if you enjoy our program, as we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, or help us as we reach out 5 hours every day. by radio, 5 hours every day on the internet, 5 hours a day on satellite, and 4 hours a day on shortwave, trying to educate people as to what's really going on. The fact that we're involved in a spiritual battle, that for the souls of men, the ultimate goal of the enemy is the one world government and the new world religion, that America is under attack today in the process of globalism is an intent to undermine the fabric of our society. Many things are being done in the name of health, water fluoridation, many of the foods we're eating are aimed at specifically weakening the both the body and the minds of the American people. As incredible as it seems, you need to get some of the material we have available, or you'll certainly want to get our November newsletter, which will give you facts and information you will never read elsewhere. If you're out there listening audience, would like a copy of our November newsletter, where we tell you about how they openly admit exactly what they want to do and how they want to put poisons in the drinking water to control the population and the minds of our people. This is not what I say, this is what they say. If you'd like a free copy of our November newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and we'll certainly be glad to send you a free copy of our November newsletter. Of course, we hope you'll want to subscribe to the Radio Liberty newsletter on a monthly basis, or better still, join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Well, let me just mention, we carry this book of David Wade's. It's called Infamy Revisited. We think it's an excellent book. We believe that you're going to get information here you'll never get elsewhere. We do have a four-tape set, incidentally, on Pearl Harbor. It's called Pearl Harbor, four-tape set. And you'll hear there an interview with Robert Stinnett, who wrote the book, Day of Deception. We have an interview with John Toland, who wrote the book Infamy, and he was a very, very famous and well-known author, died here a few years ago. But before he passed away, we, of course, recorded his testimony and his interview, and you'll find it fascinating, an interview with Dr. Thomas Moore, who is, of course, the most revered of all of our military officers. He was head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff during the Vietnam War, and Thomas Moore has gone to be with the Lord. But we do have an interview with him. He was a young ensign of a flyer at Pearl Harbor on the 7th of December. So it's a fascinating tape set, important part of history. So if you, of course, order the book Infamy, or get the four tape set, or hopefully you'll get both of them together, this will, of course, give you the insight and understanding, because if you don't understand the past, why, I believe you are condemned to repeat it. One of the callers called in and wanted to know if Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a globalist, and of course he was a globalist. He was a 32nd degree Mason. He was dedicated to this idea of world government, and that is why in 1935 he allowed the emblem, the secret emblem that you see on the back of the dollar bill, the pyramid cap of the all-seeing eye, to be put there. And of course, if you see this latest movie, National Treasury, they deal a lot with that emblem. Well, you must understand that is not a Masonic emblem. Although FDR was a Mason, the Masons use that emblem, but it is the emblem of the ancient mystery religions. It goes back some 5,000 years, and it has always been used by the secret societies. It was used certainly by the Masons, but it had been used long, long, long before that. It had been used at the time of Alexander the Great. If you don't believe that, you'll want to get the movie. It's called The Man Who Would Be King, with Sean Connery. It's a great movie, but of course The Man Who Would Be King, you'll want to get that, and you'll find that emblem was used there by Alexander the Great. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the time for us to go. We want to say goodnight to our listeners in the Great Northwest. You can listen to us on the internet at RadioLiberty.com, or on shortwave for the second hour. That's RadioLiberty.com or shortwave. Till tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station that you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Our guest this evening is David Wade. He's a freelance writer on military history, graduated at DePaul University in Chicago, and of course graduated back in 1973 with a major in modern European history, and he certainly has been fascinated by the military, by history, and has done a great job of writing this book. Have you written other books as well, David?
Well, I haven't written any other books. I've written numerous articles on military history. This was actually my first book. As a matter of fact, I've been doing some work on producing another book, which will be about the atomic bomb and the end of the war in the Pacific. Sort of a follow-up on Pearl Harbor.
Well, I think one of the most tragic parts of the whole story of the Second World War really is laid out in an article we have, and we'll make it free to anybody out there in the listening audience who would like a copy, who is published by the Chicago Tribune in August of 1945. The very day that America was signing the peace treaty with Japan on the decks of the Missouri, battleship Missouri, in the harbor, Tokyo Harbor. And the article says that the Japanese have been trying to surrender for 6 months, 5 to 7 months, something like that. The Japanese have been trying to surrender, and we wouldn't let them surrender. All they asked was simply unconditional surrender, except that Hirohito would not be tried.
Yes, well, that was a great blunder. We never made that clear. The Potsdam Declaration said that Japan had to surrender or they would be dealt with swift and utter destruction. And that was the declaration that President Harry Truman approved at Potsdam. It said nothing about the future of the Japanese emperor. We didn't seem to comprehend how important it was to them to be able to keep their emperor. I think that if we had been willing to make that concession, they may very well have negotiated a peace with us that would have avoided the use of the atomic bomb. As it was, we were faced with that terrible dilemma. Should we invade Japan and suffer God only knows how many thousands of casualties? Or should we use the bomb to end the war?
Why didn't we just accept their peace negotiations? I know, I talked to General Albert Wedemeyer, who is in command of all of our forces in Japan, and of course the Japanese offered unconditional surrender after the first atom bomb fell, and we wouldn't accept it because we wanted to drop the second bomb. And I really believe, David, there are evil people in the world who really don't see anything wrong with mass destruction. We didn't have to invade Japan because they were ready to surrender, and we wouldn't let them. That is the unconscionable part of it. And some people say it was stupidity, but I'm not certain it was stupidity. The Germans had been trying to surrender for a year, but of course we wouldn't let them surrender. They were quite willing to surrender long as we would promise.
That was another one of Roosevelt's great blunders, I think, and a lot of other historians I think would agree with me, including Thomas Fleming, who has written a brilliant book called The New Dealer's War. Roosevelt insisted on unconditional surrender. And this was something that he came up with at the Casablanca conference.
Well, either that or, of course, he wanted to prolong the war.
And that actually did prolong the war because it stiffened German resistance, because they interpreted unconditional surrender to mean that you are going to move in, you're going to occupy our country, and you're going to turn us into your slaves. Even Germans who didn't like Hitler continued resisting once they found out that we were demanding unconditional surrender.
Hold that thought.
They thought it would mean the end of Germany as a nation.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America because this is really such an important subject. It happened 63 years ago, Pearl Harbor, but, of course, what happened then is so apropos of what happened just a little over 3 years ago here in the United States. Another Pearl Harbor, but there were people who wanted the Pearl Harbor, like episode or incident, so we could go to war in the Middle East, because that was what was planned ahead of time. And if you doubt that, you need to go to their website, not my website, but their website, newamericancentury.org, the men who surround the president planned this going back to the late 1990s. 1997, they laid the plan out. You can see who was at the meetings where they were planning. This is their website, not ours. You need to get the information. You need to evaluate it. And then ask yourself, was what happened on September 11th really a surprise, or was it an excuse so they could carry out their already agreed upon plan? Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the men who did come forward. There was a commander. Was his name Stafford?
Lawrence Stafford. Stafford.
Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about?
Well, Lawrence Stafford worked at the Office of Naval Intelligence on Connecticut Avenue in Washington D.C. And he claimed that he saw among the decodes. Several days before Pearl Harbor, get the exact day, but several days before Pearl Harbor, the message, which read simply, "East wind, rain."
Now, what was the significance of that?
Well, we knew, because we had cracked the Japanese diplomatic code, that there were a series of messages that the Japanese had prepared that they would send out in the event that Japan was going to go to war. And these messages would tell you which country they were going to go to war against. And there was a message, a north wind storm, I believe it is, which meant that they would be going to war against Russia. And there was another message about south wind, which referred to British possessions in Southeast Asia, Singapore, Malaya. And there was yet another message which referred to the United States, Nakaze Ami Go Ami, I think it was, which means east wind rain. This was known. We'd cracked their code. We knew the significance of this message. And Stafford swore up and down that he saw it.
In other words, he was working in military intelligence.
He was working in naval intelligence.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. We'll have our stations come on board with it. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is David Wade, the author of Infamy Revisited. And it's a concise, excellent overview of what really happened on December 7th, 1941. And David is telling us about a Commander Stafford who worked for Naval Intelligence in Washington, D.C., and swore under oath that he had seen the East Wind Rain,
yes.
Message. And, of course, they knew, because they'd broken the Japanese code, that this meant Japan was going to war with the United States. And, of course, as soon as that message came in, it needed to be reported so our government would know that the Japanese were preparing to attack the United States. And certainly Commander Stafford reported that up the line, and suddenly after the attack on Pearl Harbor, everybody else denied that that attack had come in. Now, there were some other officers who initially corroborated his testimony, and then later they withdrew their testimony saying, well, we know what we said, but our superiors tell us that that didn't happen, and our superiors must be right, and we must have been wrong. But Commander Stafford would not retract the truth. I want to tell this story about Commander Stafford because, you know, there were honest people then, just as there are honest people today. But, of course, like Dr. David Graham of the FDA, who have recently testified the truth about the FDA, his career is ruined, and most people do not have the courage to do what he did. I've talked to people in universities who, on various issues, want to come forward and tell the truth. They've been threatened, as one of them said to me, I can't talk about it. I'm afraid for my family. I'd lose my job here at the university. Yet I can't sacrifice my family's future to tell the truth and to warn the people about what's happening. But Commander Stafford was a person who was dedicated to telling the truth. So tell the story about what happened.
Well, he persisted in insisting that he had, in fact, seen that message, and everybody else denied that such a message existed. He said that the message was actually secured and put in the safe at the Office of Naval Intelligence, and lo and behold, when the contents of the safe were disclosed, there was nothing in the safe. Everything that had been put in that safe, along with the alleged East Wind Rain message, had mysteriously disappeared. And there were a number of other people who later came forward and said, yes, as a matter of fact, we saw the message too, but we were never called upon to testify, and as a matter of fact, we were told by our superiors that if we were called upon to testify, that we were to refuse to do so, and for reasons of national security. This is very strange, of course, because a subpoena, a congressional subpoena, is a very powerful legal instrument, but nonetheless, it can be trumped if you plead national security, which is exactly what the Navy Department did. None of these people ever testified, and as a matter of fact, poor Commander Stafford, his career was ruined. He was told to report to a naval psychiatrist, undergo a battery of psychiatric tests, and he was considered a delusional character, was dismissed from the service. And the whole story is really very sad. I was some of the other people who later came forward and said that they actually saw the message was the Assistant Chief of Naval Operations Royal Ingersoll, Colonel Carlisle Dusenberry with the Army Intelligence, and Moses Pettigrew, just to name three of them, and Warrant Officer Ralph T. Briggs. But none of those people were ever called upon to testify. And Stafford also tried to obtain corroboration of his story from Lieutenant Elwin Kramer, and that was the guy who was responsible for keeping the safe. And Kramer himself proved to be of no help to Stafford, and as a matter of fact, he refused to testify on Stafford's behalf. And as I said, Stafford ended up being remanded to the psycho ward by his naval superiors because they said that he must be a delusional personality.
So much for loyalty to a loyal naval officer.
Yeah.
And, of course, the trouble is that everything was a cover-up. At that time, and, of course, we're talking about 1946, 1947, 1948, the same thing is going on today, except they're much smarter today than they were. You know, back in those days, they had the 911 Commission to investigate if the president was involved and who was it who appointed the head of the committee. Why, it was the very president who was supposed to be investigated. Mm-hmm. And then not only that, but the president set up the rules for the 911 Commission, how it would be construed, and of course there were literally hundreds and hundreds of people who were called to testify, and they testified under oath, and all of that information was kept secret and has been sealed for 30 years. Well, why, if there's nothing to conceal, are they concealing all of that testimony?
It's incredible. Well, there are thousands of documents relating to Pearl Harbor that remain classified as top secret and are not available to the public to this day.
To this very day, thousands of documents are still top secret now.
And there were other crucial documents that we have that historians have attempted to obtain, and they found out you go through the index to the archives. The archives will tell you where the documents are supposed to be. Through the Freedom of Information Act, they are allowed access to the archives. They go there, and guess what? They're missing. There were some 71 different monograms that reached President Roosevelt from our naval intelligence in the Pacific, from Station Cast in the Philippines, and Station Hypo in Hawaii prior to Pearl Harbor. Only five of them have ever been identified and located. All the rest of them are missing, and no one can account for that.
And, of course, this is how they've managed to cover things up through the years. So much of the information surrounding the death of President Kennedy is still sealed and is still being kept secret. Why is it being kept secret here? I mean, the murder of President Kennedy took place 32 years ago, mm-hmm. 42 years ago now. And yet, of course, it's all still considered secret. Why? Are they trying to keep, the communists from knowing what they knew? No, they don't want the American people to know.
That's right. Well, I think my theory is that you have here a sort of professional courtesy. That regardless of who is in power, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican administration, they keep each other's secrets. Because by doing that, they ensure that future administrations will reciprocate.
Or do you think maybe they're all...
tacit understanding that the President of the United States keeps the secrets of other presidents that have gone before him so that in return, the presidents that succeed him will reciprocate and keep his secrets.
Or is it possible that both political parties are really controlled by some other force, an X-force out there that really manipulates all of us and, of course, is concealing the secrets because they don't want the American people to know this other force exists?
Well, you know, people always poo-poo conspiracy theories, but if you look at history, so much has been accomplished by conspiracies, and conspiracies which are plainly identifiable. People conspire all the time. People get together and... agree on a common object and work secretly to bring it about. Nothing is more plain from the study of history than that this goes on all the time.
Well, I know everybody knows, or anybody with an ounce of intelligence knows there was a conspiracy on the morning of September 11th. How do we know that? Well, because we're told that 11 people got together and conspired to seize four airplanes and crash two of them into the World Trade Center and one into the Pentagon. That was a conspiracy, so why should we be so offended when people talk about a conspiracy when this was an obvious conspiracy, if we are to believe what we're told?
I have no way of explaining that other than simply to say that there's a certain naivete there. Still in America... a great number of people who love this country, but their love and devotion is misdirected because they confuse the country with the government.
Right.
And they feel that loyalty to their country demands loyalty to the government. I always liked a quotation from General Douglas MacArthur, who once said during his imbroglio with Harry Truman over the Korean War, he said, "It is important to make a distinction between loyalty to this country and the Constitution and those who temporarily happen to occupy positions of power."
So by mistake, the assumption of power by Harry Truman was, shows that really fate has a sense of humor.
Everybody
tells us what a great president he was, and he wasn't. He was a bumpkin, and he did a great deal of harm to this country. And he dropped those atom bombs and killed almost 200,000 people, totally needlessly, in my estimation. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And incidentally, any of you out there in the listening audience would like a free copy of the Chicago Tribune article we got from the Chicago Tribune telling about how the Japanese have been trying to surrender for 6 months, and we wouldn't even consider that. All they asked was that Hirohito not be tried as a war criminal. That's mm-hmm. the only request at all, because he was the very essence of the national identity. And, of course, we didn't try him as a war criminal. We never would have. He was part of a secret society called the Order of the Garter, and, of course, he was part of it before the Second World War, and he was part of it after the World War. And who do you find there? Why, you find the black nobility of Europe. You find the nobility of Great Britain. And, of course, it's an incredible organization. It's been around since the 1300s, founded in the occult. The Order of the Garter. Isn't it amazing that most people have never even heard of it? Or that Hirohito, the Emperor of Japan, the wicked Emperor of Japan, was a member of that, where he was rubbing shoulders and cavorting with the very people he was at war with. Well, we'll be back here in just a moment or two at Radio Liberty, and, of course, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464 800-259-8295. Our guest, David Wade, the book, Infamy Revisited. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. We've got Mike on the line from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How you doing? Mike, are you there?
Yeah. Hi, Stan.
Okay. How you doing?
Okay, good. Yeah, just a comment on the subject of making the world safer for democracy.
Right.
You know, as usual, the truth is hiding in plain sight. They are telling us what they intend to do. And let me just say, you have to notice that they're not saying that all these wars are to make the world safer for constitutional republics. This is for democracy, which is really a code word or pathway to socialism, which is just another code word or pathway or sales pitch for communism or fascism. And so they are telling us what they're doing. They just have us snookered in their terminology and their sophistry.
I think it's the most amazing thing, Mike, that they've been able to convince 95% of the American people that America is a democracy. In fact, that was one of the things that really got to me back in 1962 when I first heard that America was not a democracy, we were a republic. And I said, that couldn't be true because I'm a college graduate and I got a Phi Beta Kappa key and I'm pretty smart. And I really didn't realize how stupid and uneducated I was. I'd been not educated, but indoctrinated at the University of California, minored in history. And you're absolutely right. Once we can convince the people that everybody is lying to them, then, of course, maybe like, of course, the Truman and the story of the Truman Show, why part that Jim Carrey mm-hmm. played, maybe they would wake up to what's going on.
Well, if you read the Federalist Papers written by Alexander Hamilton and James Madison and John Jay, you find that democracy is a cuss word. And one of the problems that they addressed in that is how are we going to devise a representative government which does not degenerate into a democracy?
Amen to
that. They defended the Constitution of the United States and advocated its adoption by the various states simply because it wasn't a democracy, and they went to great lengths to explain why it wasn't a democracy, so that you didn't have to fear that by adopting the Constitution, you would get a democracy.
Amen to that. Okay, anything else, Mike?
No, that's it, thanks.
All right, thanks very much for calling, and I would suggest for anybody who would like to evaluate what David just said, get the Federalist Papers and read the 10th of the Federalist Papers, where James Madison said, democracies are air spectacles of turbulence and contention, are incompatible with the rights of personal
liberty. That is,
liberty,
that is a verbatim
property.
Quotation. That's
and
that's
usually,
very good. Yes.
They're usually short in their lives as they are mm-hmm. violent in their deaths.
Ah, yes, yes.
Let's go to Tony calling from Escondido. Hi, Tony. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Really good to talk to you. Very good topic tonight. And Mr. Wade brought up the book, The New Dealer's War, and it just by happens, I just actually finished that book.
Yeah.
And when I look at page 467, I won't quote directly, but the author, Mr. Fleming, talks about possibly upwards around 8 million people after D-Day died in World War II, and that's all Allied troops and all Axis troops, plus even people in the concentration camps. And when you think of that, because of some type of policy that Roosevelt himself had really adhered to, that he must have unconditional surrender, and you think that war could have been ended possibly, you know, middle or maybe even early of 1944, it's horrible to think that all those people were allowed to die just for the building of a new world order to bring the world in just absolute tatters. So
my understanding is that this is Dr. Stan here, and our guest this evening is David Wade. Of course, his book Infamy Revisited. We've got Tony calling from Escondido, and of course, we were talking about the book apparently that both of them had read that I'm not acquainted with. What's the title of that book, Tony?
The title of the book is The New Dealer's War. It's written by Thomas Lemming, who is a distinguished historian. He's also written an excellent book on the First World War called The Illusion of Victory.
Yes, read that.
I would recommend both of them.
All right, fine. But I would simply point out that there are a lot more than 8 million people killed in the Second World War. Encyclopedia America.
50 million is the figure I usually come across. And I'm sure that there were more than 8 million that were killed from D-Day on to the final ending of the war in September of 45.
And it was intentionally delayed. I've talked to General Albert Wedemeyer, who was in charge of planning for the United States. He said we were ready to invade Europe in 1943, and Churchill would not see it, would not allow that. In fact, because he crossed swords with Churchill, Churchill pervaded upon FDR to have General Wedemeyer transferred, first of all, to India, where he worked with Mountbatten, and then, of course, he was transferred to China, where he became in charge of all of the military forces in China under Chiang Kai-shek. So, but, you know, Winston Churchill wanted that war to continue. He wanted as many people as possible to die because he was dedicated, as was FDR, to this idea of the New World Order. And only out of the carnage and horror and suffering of the war would people be willing to give up their sovereignty and join in this one world government that these wicked men dreamed of. Did you have anything else to say, Tony?
I just echo what you said. That war, the fruition of it had to be just as bad as it could possibly be. The whole command structure around that was not trying to end that with as little bloodshed as possible, but to make it as bad as be. Thank you for your show, Doctor.
And thanks very much for calling, Tony. And we could sort of see this going on over in Iraq. You know, when we get there, an amazing, amazing victory, and what do? Why, the first thing we do is, instead of leaving the Iraq army intact so they could maintain order, we dissolve it. We dissolve the police force. We fire the people who are running the electric department and the water department, the sewer department, and there's ultimate chaos. And then we say, well, gee, there's ultimate chaos here. Why are these people so unhappy? Why aren't they welcoming us? Now, I mean, they don't have electricity or food or water or sewage. And, we're gonna have to just put these people down and put them in their places. And we've created a cesspool.
We seem to be committed to the idea. The idea was not simply to topple Saddam Hussein and then turn the Iraqi government back to the Iraqi people. It seems to me we are committing ourselves to a long-term occupation, that Iraq is in effect to become a colony of the United States. I read today just in the newspapers how we are now constructing new military barracks and landing strips, and they're being constructed on a permanent basis. These are not the Quonset huts that are popping up. We're putting down concrete to revetments and so forth, and constructing an infrastructure that is meant to last for many years in order to accommodate the American military presence in Iraq. So our planners are planning for a long-term occupation of Iraq.
I agree. I think you're absolutely right, David. The trouble is they're lying to the American people. They've lied since the first moment we went in, and the justification of the war. The plan has always
been increasing our troop commitments.
Yeah, the plan has always been permanent station of our troops in the Middle East, but they can't tell the American people that, so they simply lie, and they figure they're not smart enough to remember what they told them before. I heard on the television tonight that out of the chaos that's going on, we're just going to have this election, but we're not going to be able to pull out at that time. We're going to have troops there for at least 10 years.
Oh, sure. 10, 20, 30 years. Who knows how long it's going to go on?
Well, let's go to Fred, who's calling from Philadelphia. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the central coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Hi, Fred. How are you doing there? How are things in Philadelphia?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I welcome this opportunity to chime in and I'll get right to my point. I was listening to, I think the show was Overnight News or NBC Now. It was one of those all-night news shows in the 90s, and they really did come. They came up with a bombshell. They said that Churchill had cabled Roosevelt on a Thursday and said that he should definitely expect attack on Pearl Harbor before Sunday. And I couldn't, obviously I didn't, you know, record that, but there was something right from the government archives that ripped out
Well, there's a historian by the name of James Costello.
Can you hold that thought? We'll get this. And those of you hang on there, we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is David Wade, author of Infamy Revisited. On the line from Philadelphia is Fred. And, David, you were starting to tell us about a historian. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Mr. Costello, who wrote a book about the Pacific War. And there's a chapter in that about how we got into the war. Now, you may recall that earlier I was talking about Secretary of War Stimson's diary and the entry on the 25th of November about how Roosevelt supposedly hit the ceiling when he discovered that the Japanese were planning to reinforce their troops in Indochina. And it was right after that that we changed our policy towards Japan 180 degrees and came up with this ultimatum demanding that they withdraw from China, that they renounce their treaty with Hitler and so forth, non-negotiable, impossible demands. Well, according to Costello, it was on that same evening, which would have been the evening of the 25th of November, that Churchill sent a message to Roosevelt, and he speculates that this message told Roosevelt about the impending attack on Pearl Harbor. There is public record of a message that Churchill did send Roosevelt. The message that we have does not mention Pearl Harbor, but what it mentions is China, and it says, don't you think we ought to do something more to help Chiang Kai-shek? Isn't he living on a rather thin diet, I believe was the exact phrase that Churchill used. But Costello said, what would have induced Roosevelt to do a 180-degree turn in his policy towards negotiating with Japan? And Costello concludes that it may very well have been that there was a secret part to that message which has been excised and suppressed. And the secret part of that message was that Japan is going to attack Pearl Harbor. And the British knew this because we had loaned the British a magic machine.
Yeah. That was a decoding machine, right?
The decoding machine that broke the purple code. And the British had actually decoded Japanese cable traffic that told them of the impending attack on Pearl Harbor. And they had gotten the word before we did, and Churchill was relaying it to Roosevelt.
Well, David, if I may, I think that it's kind of a difficult area to research.
Hold that thought for just a moment.
Yep.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is David Wade. We have calling us from Philadelphia, Fred, and we're talking about a message that Churchill had sent to Roosevelt shortly before the war, telling him that the attack was coming at Pearl Harbor. Our telephone number is at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. Out across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-24-LIBERTY. If you have a question or comment, get it. Go ahead there, Fred. What were we going to say?
Yes. I think that there's no contradiction between the piece that I heard and his scholarship and mm-hmm. Costello's scholarship. I just would say that I think that the excuse that the administration had, that Roosevelt had, the West had, was that there was such a huge time frame they could not set up any kind of defenses because they only had a general feeling that there would be an attack. But that isn't true. There was obviously a way to defend Hawaii, and they simply chose not to because of the political situation, and they had their own plans. And there was one more thing. I had found out that there was actually, before the Lend-Lease, either executive order, I guess, or act that most people know about, there was three covert Lend-Lease efforts, three executive orders that were put into effect before that. So Roosevelt wanted to have that flexibility to move the country in a way without getting permission from the people or Congress, and I think...
Oh, sure. And as a matter of fact, one thing that isn't understood or widely acknowledged is that Roosevelt issued a secret order to the U.S. Navy to provide armed escort for the Lend-Lease convoys, with a further order that they were to shoot back if they were attacked by German U-boats. Now, this, in fact, is under international law an act of war, which would have required, under our Constitution, a declaration of war. We were supposed to be a neutral country, but here we were shipping war materials to a country that was at war with another country, and providing our Navy as escort across the Atlantic under orders to fire if fired upon by the enemy vessels of the country that we were aiding. That's a clear act of war. We were acting as a belligerent under international law without a declaration of war by Congress.
And then, of course, the Lend-Lease was really to lend Great Britain 50 American destroyers or ships of war, and they were going to lease us a little island or something. It was simply an excuse for
the
massive
naval
funding of the Great Britain.
Right. The British naval bases in the Caribbean.
Right.
Yes,
were exchanged for that.
And also, I've come across efforts to start this Pan-American Union, or certainly the enlisting the Latin American countries in a way that I don't think Congress or the people would have approved of. There was secrecy, there was executive
Roosevelt was doing all sorts of things without the knowledge or consent of Congress that were actually acts of war. And the most flagrant thing was his secret agreement with Winston Churchill in Argentia Bay. Most students of the Second World War are aware of the famous meeting that took place in Argentia Bay off the coast of Newfoundland in the summer of 1941. They got together, Roosevelt and Churchill, and they issued the so-called Atlantic Charter, the Four Freedoms: freedom from fear, freedom from want, freedom of religion. I forget the fourth one, but at any rate, this generated a lot of publicity. But at the same meeting, privately, Roosevelt met with Churchill and promised Churchill that Roosevelt would come into the war on the side of Great Britain if Great Britain were attacked by Japan in the Pacific. Now, what this means is that he, in effect, concluded a solemn treaty committing the United States to hostilities without the advice and consent of the Senate of the United States.
And here
that is blatantly unconstitutional.
And this was a man who had said in 1940, I hate war, Eleanor
hates
war,
yes.
Little Fala hates war, no American boy will ever die on foreign soil.
Yes, I've said it before and I will say it again and again and again.
Right.
Your boys will not be sent into combat in a foreign war. And he had made this commitment to Churchill. Now, here's the interesting thing about Pearl Harbor. What if the Japanese had attacked British possessions in Southeast Asia but had not attacked Pearl Harbor? Then Churchill would have really been in, or rather Roosevelt, would have been in a pickle. If he kept his word to Churchill, he would have ordered America to attack the Japanese in the Pacific, and come to the aid of Great Britain.
Well, I think that Great
Britain... And if he had done that, very well, well that he had been subject to impeachment.
Well, Dr. Stan, it seems pretty clear that you go back to World War One, you go back to World War Two, and it's at a period immediately before that World War Two, and you have the kind of companies that really were never heard in the 20th century were these international cartels. They weren't hurt. They seemed to take this all in stride. And I've looked at a old encyclopedia article on cartel, and it was actually pretty bold. And you can't even get that kind of scholarship today. It's kind of that old scholarship is very incisive, and it's incredible how these cartels have been just latching onto us and dogging us down this whole, just for centuries, and we can't seem to shrug these people off.
But you see behind them are dark spiritual forces, and until you address the spiritual forces that energize this and that control the wealth of the world, you really can't see effectively what's going on. This is what most of the scholars on this subject have missed. We are really involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political battlefield or an economic battlefield or a cultural battlefield until you address the spiritual forces that energize this. You know, we're not going to get any place at all.
And the cartels have also innovated to the extent where they have an information cartel.
And that's right, and they have their own armies, and they kill people. They do not hesitate at all to polish people off. They operate outside the law.
That's
you know,
true.
You hear about all of these great corporations here that are cheating on this, that, and the other thing, and they're not going to jail. Martha Stewart's going to go to jail because she told a fib to somebody, not even under oath. She just said, well, I didn't sell that stock. You know, I didn't have advanced knowledge. I don't know whether she had advanced knowledge or not. But what about the people in these great corporate, for instance, AIG recently is going to pay $126 million for fraudulent activity. Well, if it was that bad, they're going to pay $126 million. Why isn't
somebody
going to jail?
Why doesn't somebody go to jail?
Right.
Well,
of course, nobody goes to jail.
That,
when
right.
you're rich enough, you don't go to jail. Martha Stewart is just a piker. Anything else, Fred?
I want to say that just keep on with your program. Don't let anything stop you. You have something that remains a free medium, the shortwave bands, and we have to support the shows like yours.
Oh, God bless you. And please tell others about our program. Your job is to tell other people and get them listening to shortwave and get them listening on the internet. Well, I'll do the message. I'll get the information out, get good guests like David Wade. But you got to get people listening.
This is a marvelous show. Thank you very much.
God bless. Bye-bye. Well, our telephone number, again, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or our 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. Our guest this evening, of course, is David Wade. His book, Infamy Revisited, a fascinating overview, of course, of what really happened. There were a number of investigations at Pearl Harbor. Finally, of course, there was a naval investigation where at least you would have some integrity, because I would say of all the services there, maybe the Marines accepted the Navy is the one where people have always clung to integrity and truth. Of course, there's corruption within our Navy, but there are an awful lot of good people there. And when they had a full investigation, they exonerated Admiral Kimmel of responsibility for what happened and pointed out that, of course, he was intentionally and purposely left out of the loop. Information was withheld from him, and of course, he was in no way responsible for Pearl Harbor. And indirectly, of course, he incriminated the Roosevelt administration. Do you want to comment at all about that part of the investigation, David?
Well, Admiral Kimmel was a man of enormous integrity. He was a diligent, hardworking, conscientious man. And he found himself in a position where he had to make a choice. He had been told that if war broke out in the Pacific, the likely Japanese targets would be Guam and Midway, and that he should be prepared to sortie his fleet and his air arm in order to come to the aid of a beleaguered Guam and Midway. The main thing that everyone who has criticized Kimmel has found wrong with his conduct is his refusal to exercise aerial reconnaissance. And I think that's a bum rap. The reason why it is a bum rap is because Kimmel had only so many airplanes, and he only had so much gasoline, and he felt that he had to conserve both his planes and his gasoline for the real task that would devolve upon him when war came, namely aid to Wake and Guam.
But
and therefore, he held back from exercising a comprehensive aerial reconnaissance.
But they had ordered, Washington, D.C., had ordered all of the carriers out of Pearl Harbor.
Yes, they had ordered all of the carriers out of Pearl Harbor just before it was attacked. Wasn't that fascinating?
And because, of course, they knew that the next war would be fought with aircraft carriers.
Yes,
and
the Lexington, the Enterprise, and the Saratoga were all elsewhere when the Second World War began with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And the ships that were actually sunk at Pearl Harbor were all obsolescent old battle wagons left over from the First World War that would not have been able to play much of a role anyway. Interesting.
Well, I think that was part of it. And then Admiral Kimmel had actually taken his fleet and put it to sea, you know, on maneuvers, and he was ordered to...
And he was ordered back. This was something that came out in Stinnett's book that was not generally acknowledged until Stinnett wrote that book. He had him out on maneuvers. He was told, take your ships, bring them back to Pearl Harbor, and keep them.
And that's because, I believe, because they would make an ideal target, and they knew they would make an ideal target. If they were at sea, they'd be much harder to hit, whereas, of course, they were there at the Pearl Harbor. They knew exactly where they were.
Their hands were tied, and they were lined up like sitting ducks on the morning of December 7, 8 a.m.,
and just like, of course, what happened on September 11th after the first plane hit the North Tower, and, of course, the people in the South Tower, the Twin Towers, were looking out the window at the fire and the flames and the smoke, and they could see people standing in the windows of the North Tower and some of them leaping to their death. And then comes the announcement over the loudspeaker in the South Tower, stay at your desk, you are not to leave your desk, everything's secure, there's nothing to worry about. And up on the top floor of the South Tower, why the security man in charge of security is racing up and down the aisle saying, we're under attack, we're under a terrorist attack, get out of the building, don't ignore what's saying on the loudspeaker. And the man in charge, rescued 1,700 people. They got them off those top two floors, and they could have gotten everybody out of the South Tower. And somebody put an announcement out over the loudspeaker, do not leave your post. And the people who believed that and did what they were told died.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to suggest that it's about time we quit doing what we're told to do and understand that we have to be involved in what's going on. For if you don't stand up on your feet now and say no, you may very well be on your knees saying yes.
The lesson of Pearl Harbor, it seems to me, is the same as the lesson about 9/11. And the lesson is this. Don't necessarily believe what your government tells you. Exercise a certain amount of healthy skepticism. Do not confuse loyalty to your country with blind obedience to your government.
Amen to that. I think that is probably the most important thing we can learn from this program this evening. Do not confuse loyalty to your country with blind obedience to government. Because, unfortunately, I believe our government has been taken over by dark spiritual forces that control both political parties. I believe our country is the greatest country in the world because it was once a Christian nation. But everything is being done now to destroy that Christian foundation. They're taking Christ out of Christmas and they're taking Christ out of our schools, and they're even changing the music and the message of our churches across America. And when are the good people going to stand up and say, no more? Well, David, we just got a few more minutes before we have to let you go, and it's been a fascinating day. This is we've spent almost 4 hours, at least 3.5 hours with David on our
very program. I feel like I'm almost a member of the family. Yeah. I should move in.
Well, I hope if you ever get out here to California, we'll come by and see us here.
I would appreciate that, yeah.
But anyway, of course, what is the message that really you've learned as studying Pearl Harbor? And, of course, this book was actually published back in 2002, so it was after the 9/11 attack.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, your message basically would be, don't trust what we're being told. But what should people do now at the present time with the knowledge they've gained from this program?
Well, I think that people should, as I say, exercise a certain amount of healthy skepticism about what they are told by those in a position of authority. And I think that we have to learn that there are forces at work in our government who do not necessarily have the best interests of America in mind, whose conception of America's self-interest is not the traditional conception of it at all. We can see this, I think, not only in the case of the Second World War, but also in our present embroilment in Iraq. One wonders whether, in fact, the national self-interest of Israel are not ranked above those of the United States.
Hold that thought right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course we may have one more caller. If we do have, I hope Kevin will go ahead and screen him on through. If not, why, of course, we'll have to wrap up the program with David Wade. And there's certainly the question is, why are we in the Middle East? Some people think we're there, of course, to defend Israel. Some people there think we're there to destroy Israel. Some people think we're there for oil. Some people think we're there for democracy. Some people think we want, of course, a base there so that we will be able to attack Iran and, of course, bring all of the countries of the Middle East under our domination. But, of course, I think my personal opinion is that there's another agenda that nobody ever talks about, a little bit beyond what we're going at tonight, but I believe that there are spiritual forces at work that are moving us towards World War III. And if you read the Old Testament, you'll find that time and again, God brought, whether it be the Assyrians or the Babylonians or the Egyptians, against the children of Israel when the children of Israel had turned their back on him. Well, I believe America was a favored nation at one time, blessed by God, but of course I believe that we have abandoned our obligation, and I believe God is going to bring terrible things to happen in America, and I believe we are being laid open for a World War III. What are your thoughts on that, David? Do you see a massive expansion of the war down the line?
Well, you know, we go back to the title of that book by Harry Elmer Barnes, Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace. And it seems to me that we are pursuing a sort of utopian vision. Our idea is, as a matter of fact, you remember there was a report that was issued under the authorship of Colin Powell, our strategic report, in September of 2003. Our new policy is going to be that any nation whatsoever that attempts to acquire weapons of mass destruction and may be friendly to the United States will be open to preemptive attack by us.
Any
nation that acquires weapons of mass destruction and threatens and is unfriendly to the United States may be subject to preemptive attack. This is a radical departure.
And of course, if it's all right for us to preemptively attack other countries,
but only us, other countries cannot preemptively attack. That's aggression.
When
we do it, we are spreading democracy and capitalism and the American way of life, and therefore it's justified.
And if we have people who are fighting on our side, they're freedom fighters. If they're fighting on the other side, they're automatically terrorists. Hey, we're out of time, David. God bless you. Thank you so very much for being with us. And
as the great German historian Leopold von Ranke once said, the labora ipsa voluptas, the labor itself is a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and it's the end of the year. We could certainly use your help if you agree that we have a unique message, that we have an approach that needs to be gotten out across America. We do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to helping Radio Liberty, so we'll end up the year with at least in the black, or at least not too far in the red. So if you'd like, of course, to get in touch with us, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. We've really massively expanded our programming this year, taking on a number of new stations, and of course taking on the evening shortwave program, which was quite an undertaking. And of course, there's not just one shortwave program station in the evening; it's two outlets in every evening. But we are reaching more people than ever before, and probably here even within the last few months, why we've picked up a half a dozen new stations. So what a unique opportunity to talk to people out across America. And of course, if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, our number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to understand the background of the financial crisis that we're moving into, and you'd like a copy of our October newsletter, call us at that number, 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you a free copy of our October newsletter, but you have to request the October newsletter. If you'd like, of course, our latest newsletter, the November newsletter, which goes on the plan program to put substances into our food and into our water, to, of course, decrease fertility, to impact on the minds of the American people, to make them more compatible, more easily manipulated, and, of course, also to lower the intelligence of the American people and our children, and the realization that this program is underway throughout America today. You'll certainly want to get a copy of our November letter. It's all documented. We give you the sources of information that you can get to verify what we're saying is true, and then you're going to have to help us get the information out. We can only reach a certain number of people on radio, but you can reach people out in your audience, and I will tell you that, I mean, we can talk all we want to about Iraq, but unless it's your son or daughter over there getting killed or maimed or crippled for life, most people aren't that concerned. Oh, they feel bad about it, but they're not really concerned. And, of course, most people aren't concerned about the loss of jobs, and unless it's their job that's gone, and then they're very concerned about jobs. Most people aren't concerned about the government coming in and taking children away from their parents unless it's your child that's taken away. But everybody's child is influenced by the plan program to, of course, medicate our children and lower their intelligence quotient forevermore. So if you'd like, of course, to get the information we're talking about, it is certainly one of the most incredible stories. And, of course, we don't quote what people on believe as I do say. We quote what people on the other side say with references that we can get for you. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We ask you to go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Get other people to go there. They can pull down our newsletters. They can listen to our programs live. They can listen to our programs, our archive programs. They can, of course, see the various items we have. And if we, of course, have the Big Berkey products. We have the Sanjian radios. We have, of course, the Robinson Homeschool curriculum and other items that you really need to have, and some excellent Christmas presents. If you're looking for books or videos or 4-tape sets that will educate people about what's going on, about their health, some wonderful books on health, wonderful books on history, the book Infamy Revisited we've been talking about this evening, and so much more, a 4-tape set on Pearl Harbor, Robert Stinnett's wonderful book, Day of Deceit. That's Infamy, Day of Deceit, or the 4-tape set on Pearl Harbor, and so much other information. Pray for America. Pray for revival. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until Thursday, when we'll be with you again. May the Lord be with you.